This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Rick Stevens of the Associated Press, in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Governor Hassan was on The Exchange this week to discuss priorities for her second term. On a controversial pipeline proposal in southern New Hampshire, Hassan said any such project must be in the state's interest and include local input.
I have indicated to Kinder Morgan that they should have extended outreach to local communities where that pipeline would pass through. They should be listening to the local communities. There have been a number of folks who've been concerned about the initial proposal that Kinder Morgan had and came up with constructive alternatives.
The governor also discussed her budget, including funding for higher education. Hassan allocated $13 million for the university system, less than what officials had requested. In his State of the University speech this week, UNH President Mark Huddleston was optimistic that the legislature would find more money.
Although the state budget proposed last week falls short of what we need to freeze tuition, I remain hopeful that we can still make our case as the legislature takes up its work in the weeks ahead.
Meanwhile, work on bills at the State House is in full swing, with several being considered this week, including decriminalizing marijuana possession. At a hearing this week, Representative Joe LaChance, a co-sponsor of the measure, argued that New Hampshire is the only state in New England with criminal penalties for simple possession.
What's the repercussion for that person who may not be able to afford college, now has a marijuana conviction, and according to federal law, you may not be eligible for federal loans or public housing? What have we done for that person for the rest of their life?
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We'd like to hear from you. Call us. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us to theexchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm Rick Stevens in for Laura Kanoy, and our guests today are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Gary, welcome to the Roundup.
Well, thank you, Rick. Good to be on your maiden voyage.
Thank you. Also with us in the studio, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University and the author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Rick.
We have a lot to talk about. Busy week. Let's start with the big news yesterday out of Maine, where Fairpoint Communications has announced the settlement of a four-month strike. Gary, this was a long-running labor issue, one of the longer-running ones that we've had in recent history.
It certainly has been, and it's been very disruptive, too, to a lot of people. Complaints went sky high here in the last few months, as they tried to fill in with management folk, and it's just not been keeping up with the work that they had to do and all the issues that they've had. It's a classic, you know, we can't compete with the old labor contract that we had. We need to do some changes. And the unions are saying, well, you know, it shouldn't be all on our backs. There ought to be other things to do. So it's interesting to see. They haven't really said what the agreement is. They've been pretty quiet about that, but it'll be interesting to see what they did come up with.
They didn't talk about specific details, but Dean, what were some of the issues behind the negotiations? Well, some of them were traditional, but
a lot of the typical things you run into with these kinds of negotiations: healthcare costs, rising healthcare costs, and you know, who shares the burden of premiums for healthcare. Pensions. Pensions are a recurring problem, retirement funds, et cetera. So this went on for a long time. It affected about 1,700 workers. What interests me about this story is, you know, Fairpoint has had kind of a rocky history in the state to begin with. Landlines are a bit of a losing business these days, given the ubiquity of cell phones. They've tried to diversify into other areas. They've been leaning pretty heavily on the strike issue as an explanation for why their service has been so poor. I had some problematic experiences with them before the labor strike. So this is going to be a good test of whether or not getting the workers back online really solves a lot of these problems that I think people are going weeks without dial tones. They have no other alternative for internet service. So this is going to be a big test. They've used the strike as, I don't want to say excuse, but as a reason for a lot of their service problems. I think it's a little bit deeper than that. We'll see if this does the trick. But typical contract stuff, pensions, retirement, et cetera.
Dee, what do they need to do now going forward? We know Gary referenced the fact of the complaints. You've mentioned some concerns as well.
Yeah.
I think New Hampshire actually held up a fairly significant contract for a while anyway.
State did, yes.
Yes. Yeah. So what do they need to do in the weeks ahead to sort of rebuild the Fairpoint brand?
Well, actually, there's some groundwork in place now. I mean, one of the conditions that the – particularly Colin Van Onsten, one of the executive counselors, put on agreeing to the contract with the state was that they go around the state, they hold public hearings, they invite people in, they talk about their problems, and the president of the company said he would be there, and they would listen to what people had to say. I think that's a big first step that will help them if they really do want to – if they really can get over this hump.
So from telecom, we move into another major industry question in the region, and that's energy, of course. We heard Governor Hassan in the open talking about the Kinder Morgan pipeline proposal for southern New Hampshire. Now, this week we have more news. It's not new news. It actually was announced in September that several companies, including the former PS&H, now Eversource, and National Grid joined on this $3 billion project for a pipeline in the state as well. Dean, talk about the overarching energy questions in this region.
This has become an increasingly, I think, big problem for the state, you know, particularly during the winter. We have cold weather and people need increased access to oil and natural gas in particular for heating, but also propane. You know, the issue certainly with the natural gas pipelines has been supply during the winter months. There's apparently enough out there. It's just getting it into the region that is problematic, which is why you're having these proposals for new pipelines. But, you know, what we've seen, whether we're talking about the Northern Pass and electricity or natural gas pipelines with Kinder Morgan or wind project with the Iberdrola, the Spanish company, you know, citing these projects, moving them forward has become very difficult. And the issue is, you know, you have kind of this collective good argument about the need to get more resources into the state, but it butts up against property rights in a very libertarian state. In the end, a lot of this stuff is going to end up in the courts. That's typically how it's resolved, and that means it's going to take a lot of time.
Well, that's what's interesting about this new proposal from Eversource or PS&H or Northeast Utilities and National Grid is it's going to go – they're proposing to expand the pipeline along existing right-of-ways. But they already have a pipeline there. It would just be a larger pipe capacity. So we don't get into all these issues of what we do with Northern Pass and with this proposal by Kinder Morgan of going through this sort of virgin territory, if you will. And the thing about this other – the other thing about this new proposal is it's a two-part one. One of them is along the seacoast. The other one is along southern New England. And that way you're getting gas out of both – basically out of the Maritimes and also from the west and the Pennsylvania, New York fields.
One of the other unique parts of this proposal, the second proposal we're talking about here, is the way they would pay for it. Rather than putting it on the gas users, they anticipate – spreading the cost out to electric users too. So sort of a unique way to fund it as well. So we'll see where this one goes as it works through the regulatory process.
And that was a proposal that the New England governors floated out there last summer before it got into some hot water.
That's right. Good. Okay, more business-related stuff coming out of the legislature this week. And it's a term we talk about a lot here on the show, and as we've talked about it in the state, casino gambling. And of course, Governor Hassan in her budget did not include anything, any revenues from a casino. She did include casino light, I guess they've been calling it, keno gaming, gambling. But here's Lou D'Alessandro for, what is it, the 17th year with a bill. So, Gary, tell us what's happening with casino gambling in New Hampshire.
Well, just before we get into that, Larry, Lou called himself the Larry Prickett of casinos. Well, Larry was the guy who for years and years and years proposed the state lottery. And for years and years and years, legislators voted it down. And finally, they approved it, I think, in the early 60s. And ever since then, we were the first state lottery, and we've been going great guns since. But Lou is now talking about a casino again and again. This is the 17th year, as we said. He's talking about two casinos, not one, which is what the governor prefers, a small one and a large one. And he's talking about also a little sweetener here, which is $25 million in revenue sharing for the cities and towns. Revenue sharing ended with the legislature back several years ago when we had some budget crunches. And this makes it a little easier to take for a lot of lawmakers who might otherwise not think too kindly of it.
And what's interesting is, you know, Governor Hassan didn't explicitly mention casino gambling in her budget address this time around, although she still clearly supports it. And the second casino that you mentioned, the smaller one, would, I think, add an additional $40 million in licensing fees on top of the $80 million for the larger one. You know, it has good support in the Senate. You got Chuck Morse, the Republican leader, supporting it. You've got Jeff Woodburn, the Democratic leader, supporting it. Governor Hassan, obviously, the question is going to be the House. You know, it was closer last time than it's been, but there's still no guarantee. And it was interesting. Last time around, Keno was kind of put to the side for fear that it was going to interfere with casino gambling. Now, this time, Governor Hassan is actually explicitly asking for Keno revenue, but it's a lot less. I think it's something like $25 million.
$25 million in the first year, about 40 in the second.
Yeah, it's a little bit more.
Well, Dina, you mentioned that the Governor Hassan does support it. She didn't include anything in her budget,
right.
But then she came out this week and said in an interview that, sure, I still support it, but I didn't include it because of the political headwinds here. What's the context or the subtext maybe of that statement and that progression from the governor?
Yeah, I think she's – you know, I'm sort of guessing at what's inside her head, but I think she's concerned about it kind of becoming a – it really became kind of like the linchpin of her budget. Once it was in the budget last time, that's all anybody talked about, even though it was only $80 million of a $10 billion budget. So – I think the concern is she, you know, kind of in the way that they handled the gas tax where, you know, she's interested in a proposal, she'll support it, but she doesn't want like everyone becoming preoccupied with that aspect of her agenda.
Okay. Thank you. We are coming up into a break here, but afterwards we will come out talking about a lot of stuff going on at the legislature, gun control and marijuana decriminalization, auto inspections, and other topics happening there. This is the Friday News Roundup on The Exchange, and we'd like to hear from you. So call us at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. So join us in a moment when we return to The Exchange. Welcome back. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Rick Stevens of the Associated Press, in this week for Laura Kanoy. Joining me in the studio, Gary Reno from the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. We've got a lot of ground to cover here. The legislature, as they head into their winter break week, they had a very busy week, a lot of topics, a lot of on the ground, sort of street level topics that affect a lot of people in New Hampshire and certainly flavor the debate with that typical New Hampshire spirit. Gary Reno, auto inspections. There was a measure out that would have delayed auto inspections. Not delayed, but spaced them out. Tell us what happened there.
Well, the proposal would have been for auto safety inspection as opposed to air emissions inspections, but auto safety inspections every 2 years. The people who were pushing it said, well, you know, we have modern cars now. They're all got computerized. They don't need the same sort of inspection that we used to have before. They'll tell you all of the things that are wrong with your car. So this is kind of redundant. There's no data that backs up any, that yearly inspections make anything any safer. They don't reduce crashes to any extent. And largely it was also kind of backed by people who are liberty lovers, if you will, who don't want to see any more government involvement than they have to, and so they thought this was a way of getting rid of some of that involvement. But the House didn't agree with it. They voted it down this week. So we're back to having a yearly inspection.
And Dean, this is sort of one of the, it's the live free or die state. So this is not an unusual tactic here. But
yeah, it's true. And I think I've mentioned on a previous show, I lived for many years in a state that did not have any auto inspection. And it was amazing some of the stuff you saw people have out on the road with, you know, duct tape and rubber bands to hold their cars together. I understand the argument about the newer cars really not needing inspections in the way that some of the older models do. And I think they had a way to make it so there wouldn't be a loss in revenue for cutting back on that and probably raise the fee.
Double the fee,
right? Yeah. I think it's still just kind of a safety concern. And in the end, I think they decided to keep things the way it is, the way they are.
They had a couple of garage owners come in to testify, and one of them brought in all these parts that he took off upscale automobiles, if you will, the Audis and the Porsches and so on. And he brought in some of these parts that he took off cars that went through inspections. And, I mean, they were falling apart. And he said, people, these are good. These are really expensive cars, well-made, and this is what we find all the time.
And I will say a lot of people up here increasingly have all-wheel drive cars, whether it's a Subaru or a Volvo or an Audi. And those cars chew up tires and brakes like you wouldn't believe. So it probably is a good idea to at least have that aspect checked.
Well, sure. And in this climate, hey, we're all bouncing around on the roads right now with the potholes and the Frosties and the salt that just chews away. Now, related back to this sort of this libertarian streak, if I may use that word, another bill in the legislature this week related to guns and gun control. This is it's a perennial, happens here and in other places. Gary, can you tell us what they were talking about this week about gun control?
We were talking about background checks for all firearms. Federally, you have a background check for pistols, but you don't have a background check for rifles and so on. And this would require background checks for all firearms. We used to say it would be a modest proposal, but with the heat turned up under the issue here the last few years, it's gotten to be quite controversial. And it had a lot of people backing in, a lot of sponsors of the bill. But with this House particularly, where it was the House that voted on the first day of the session to allow guns in the chamber again, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, we also have the issue with the people wanting to do away with the separate licensing for concealed carry. Right now, you want to carry, you can open carry. If you can buy a gun, you can wear it in the open without any additional permitting. But if you want to have a concealed weapon, currently you need to go to your local police department and get a license. And so there's also a push to do away with that as well. I mean, these are perennial issues that come up. Both sides are fairly well entrenched at this point. But I agree with Gary. The Republican legislature would be very hard to expand the notion of a background check.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Today is the New Hampshire News Roundup. Remember, we'd love to hear from you. The phone number here, 1-800-892-6477. You can also reach out by email at exchange@nhpr.org. Look for us on Twitter or Facebook. I'd like to go back to that, Dean, in terms of the gun control. There appears to be sort of an ebb and flow of these measures. And what has insulated New Hampshire from some of the other we saw in New York right after, I think, Newtown, where they adopted a very controversial the SAFE Act. In other words, they were restricting more gun rights. What sort of sets New Hampshire apart?
Well, I think part of it is, as Gary mentioned, our libertarian tradition. We have a long history of Second Amendment gun rights in the state. We may also not have quite the same level of violent crime that you get in some states with major metropolitan areas. A lot of times, as you mentioned, these are sort of react. Sometimes they ebb and flow based on kind of what's going on in the culture in terms of gun violence. It also kind of fluctuates based on sort of the political climate. You remember when President Obama was elected president, there was kind of a run on gun ammo because they thought there was going to be kind of a limitation on the size of clips you could buy. So there's a political context, there's a social context, and I also think there's this kind of geographical context as well. But it clearly ebbs and flows. But the two sides are sort of fighting this battle from year to year.
And I think, too, I mean, we've had sort of a laissez-faire attitude about gun control in this state, and it's very little of it. And, I mean, to be honest, there's been very few incidents that you might say would raised to the occasion that would cause anybody to decide that it would be a good idea to change the laws we have now.
Interesting. Our neighbor to the west, Vermont, is one of the highest gun-owning states in the nation and yet one of the safest states in terms of gun violence.
And no concealed weapons permit either in Vermont.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Another measure at the State House this week, Gary Reno, was a bill to decriminalize marijuana possession, small amounts of possession. Can you tell us what the bill would have done? It would do?
It would have made essentially small possession of an ounce or less of marijuana or 5 grams or less of hashish basically equivalent to a speeding ticket. You'd be subject to like a $100 fine. And it was three-tier system. If a teenager, there were certain things, you know, parental notification and things like that. And then there was 18 to 21 and then 21 and over. But essentially it would make it a speeding basically a speeding ticket, which in fact would sort of bring it in line with the rest of New England. In terms of that, we're a little out of line. It also would reduce the penalties for larger possession and also for manufacturing or growing marijuana. It would have been a Class A misdemeanor, which would have been a $2,000 fine and up to a year in jail. I mean, currently it's a felony.
Dean, what are the arguments in favor of this, in favor of a decriminalization? What are the supporters saying?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of support in the House for this. I think for the past decade, they've introduced something like nine different decriminalization bills. And we should say that's separate from making marijuana legal the way it is, say, in Colorado. This is just to decriminalize and reduce the penalties. You know, the thinking is that it's kind of a waste of resources. And even Governor Hassan has said that for some of these possessions, there really shouldn't be jail time. It's just the argument is that, you know, it's sort of the penalty is out of kilter with kind of the nature of the infraction. You know, the House has passed it a number of times, hasn't gotten through the Senate. I don't know that it will this time. If I had to choose, I think it would have a better chance in legalization because legalization raises a whole other set of regulatory issues. But that's the argument, that it really is sort of the penalties currently are overkill for the level of infraction. It's a waste of resources.
We heard Representative LaChance on the introduction talking about the social costs too.
Yeah, I mean, and kids who get caught with a joint of marijuana put at risk their college funding and all sorts of other things. So
what's the opposition to this? Well, there is opposition.
There is. I mean, particularly from the law enforcement community. Their argument is that they go back to this study that was done and says that the youthful brain is not fully developed, and that until you're about 25 years old. So when you're using this stuff at a young age, you are impacting your later development. That's their big argument. That argument and the fact that they say, you know, you can say it's the same as alcohol, but haven't we learned anything that we have this huge alcohol problem, we have this huge DWI problem. We go and we do this, we're sending the wrong message, and we'll be having a huge drug driving problem instead of drug driving problem.
And some hardcore opponents say that it's a gateway drug to harder drug use.
How does this square to Gary Reno with federal law? And there's been some debate in other states about how they mesh.
Federal law is still illegal. It's still a criminal act. So, but it's not – truthfully, it's not really enforced at the federal level.
Yeah, Colorado is certainly an example of that.
Yeah. Well, Dean, can you talk a little bit, too, about where we are compared to other states? We know that Colorado, Washington, they have full legalization – well, they have legalization different from decriminalization. But are these movements gaining steam in other places?
To some extent, I think they are, sure. And I think a lot of states have been waiting to see – you know, Washington State, Colorado, to see what is it really the moneymaker that proponents have suggested it is? What kind of social ills result? You know, what sort of the market? But you know, there are sort of different levels. There's the decriminalization debate. There's the legalization debate. There's the medical marijuana debate. The medical marijuana debate. A lot of states now have medical marijuana. We're in the process of getting our our system up and running here. Mm-hmm. And it's taken 2 years or almost 2 years, which I think is sort of indicative of how difficult it is to really change something like this. But I think, you know, decrim of all of those and medical marijuana are a lot more likely than, say, a full-scale legalization. I think that's still a ways off. But certainly people are pushing for it. I think polling data shows kind of people's views of marijuana and penalties has changed a little bit over time. It's just mm-hmm. sort of people have loosened up on it. I mean, I remember a time when even admitting you smoked a joint as a politician could really damage your political prospects.
Remember Bill Clinton, he smoked it, but he didn't inhale it.
Right. That was the we're starting to transition there.
Well, yeah. we did slow down on the medical marijuana after passage. What was that, 2013 that they passed the medical marijuana? But Gary, we just had another delay, I think, anyway, in the siting of these dispensaries.
That's been a real hang up here because we get into this whole issue of who wants these dispensaries. There's supposed to be four of them and out throughout the state. And every time there's one that's proposed, people get up in arms and zoning issues and various things like that. So to date, we haven't really had any proposal go forward that would have a dispensary in a community. We did pass a bill, though, the Senate did. It was the Senate this week that basically said that they'd have to pay a payment in lieu of taxes because the way the bill was set up, they're they're nonprofit entities. And nonprofit entities don't pay property taxes. And this was a huge issue, I think, over in Epsom when they were proposing it, that there would be no property taxes. So we have a bill to take care of that coming through.
Well, and we learned today out of Colorado that that state, which does have legalized marijuana, it's being sued by two neighboring states. And now some of its own residents are suing the state. They're asking a federal judge to close down the recreational marijuana industry. So, yeah, a lot of debate still out on that topic. Big topic in this state, always has been in a lot of states, and this one sort of touches all corners, the notion of education funding, both at the elementary, secondary, and post-secondary levels. Dean Spiliotis, UNH President Mark Huddleston gave his State of the University address this week. He acknowledged that the governor's budget contained less money than they had hoped for. Give us the background on the education funding at the the college level.
Sure. Yeah, and yes, as you mentioned, the UNH President Mark Huddleston did his annual State of the University address. You know, we sort of wait every year to hear whether or not tuition is going to be freezed at the college level for a lot of New Hampshire students, residents who go to UNH. He had wanted, I think, $40 million over 2 years. That was kind of the threshold to so roughly $20 million a year to freeze tuition. Governor Hassan only proposed $13 million, so it's not enough necessarily to freeze it. And he's been getting a lot of press for saying that he has thousands of activists that he can kind of activate to really kind of pressure and lobby the state legislature to so-called move the needle on education funding. So, you know, this is a perennial issue. New Hampshire State University system, one of the least state-funded systems in the country, if not the least. And it makes tuition typically higher than a lot of other state universities. And it's just tough to get – it's always a challenge to get money out of the state for the school. So, you know, he said that despite the lack of money, the university is thriving. Would have liked more to freeze tuition, but we'll see whether or not, in fact, he can kind of activate this network of activists and put effective pressure on the legislature.
Gary Reynolds, Dean mentions that the state is dead last in terms of funding its public universities.
Right.
We're among the best in high school graduation rates, but we're only in the middle of the pack sending these kids to college. Meanwhile, policymakers all agree that higher education is the way to stabilize your economy, to draw jobs in, to keep young people from leaving. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, a lot of young people are leaving New Hampshire to go to college. And I mean, some people argue that one of the reasons is because it's the state university system is so expensive that it's much more – particularly with a lot of private colleges, you have a lot more student aid available. And students can go to these private colleges. They may be more expensive even than the university system. But by the time they get their student aid and all that, it's much less expensive than to go to the university system or even the community college system. I mean, Massachusetts community college system is cheaper than New Hampshire, if even as an out-of-state person going there. And the community college system has reduced their tuition now. And while the university system trustees held off making a decision until they find out what the legislature is going to do. I mean, just to clarify, the university system wanted $52 million and they got $13 million. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to freeze tuition, I don't think, unless something changes. And they may be lucky to get $13 million before this is all over.
You're listening to The Exchange, and this is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Gary, I'd like to stay with you now at the state level, the elementary and high school levels. Two bills came up this week in the legislature. You've written about these. And again, it's money that we're talking about.
Right.
What are the two points that they're discussing and what happened this week?
There are two bills, one which would adjust the way that school districts are given state aid. There's a cap on how much money, increase in money school districts can get from year to year. Currently, it's 108%. Governor Hassan would like it to be 115%. And Representative Bates, who was on this week or last week, excuse me, talk about his plan, would just as soon do away with the cap. And it doesn't really change the formula. It just changes the fact that these towns that have or school districts that have a lot of students that are fast growing that are not getting the kind of money that they're supposed to get in their formula. This got initial approval and went to the – it's going to be going to Senate Finance. The same with the school building aid. We changed the formula a couple of years ago on that, but we've had a moratorium essentially on new building projects. They're funding the projects that were approved prior to the moratorium, but we haven't added any new projects. This bill would have added $50 million to the building aid, which would have allowed other schools, new projects to come forward. Like the other bill, it's going to the House Finance. Chances are it's probably not going to come out there, House Finance, with $50 million in it.
Gary, also, the governor has addressed the notion of the cap in her own budget, so it seems like there might be some political...
I think there's a lot of political push to do something about that,
okay.
Particularly because it's not an awful lot of money.
Terrific. We are coming into another break here on The Exchange. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm with Dean Spiliotis, at the Civic Scholar at SNHU, and also Gary Reno of the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Coming up in about a minute and a half, we'll be talking about, guess what, presidential politics here in the state. We'd love to hear from you. The phone number again, 1-800-892-6477. You can reach us at email, on an email at exchange@nhpr.org, or look for us on Twitter or Facebook. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Exchange. It's the New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Rick Stevens of the Associated Press, sitting in this week for Laura Kanoy. I'm joined by Gary Reno of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. Guys, if it's February, the year before a presidential election, we must be talking about, presidential politics. But before we get to that, I'd like to just wrap up our discussion on the legislature. There are some bills out there, freedom of information related. This is the state's right to know laws, and there are a couple of measures or a couple of topics being discussed. Gary, what is the legislature looking at in terms of right to know, changes to the right to know law, and the effect it will have on people making requests of public officials?
I think the biggest change that they're talking about is allowing cities and towns and school districts and counties and even state government to charge for the time it takes to retrieve these documents. They've always been able to charge for the copies and so on, but most do not charge for the time. And this would allow people to charge for the time after the first hour. I mean, there are certain communities. This is particularly this bill is from Pat Long, who is a Manchester alderman. And Manchester has had some rather wide-ranging right-to-know requests, particularly for emails from various aldermen, et cetera. And it's very time-consuming. I mean, the AG has been to the legislature for the last 4 or 5 years saying, you've got to do something about this. It's costing us a lot of money and time to take care of these right-to-know requests. And they're getting some very wide, broad requests. And then when you can, if you're in the AG's position, you got to go through them. You got to do redactions. You got to do all this sort of thing.
Yeah, it's very labor intensive. It's very labor intensive. I think they're talking about maybe after the first hour charging something like minimum wage for charging the requester. You know, the issue here on the one side is, you know, potential abuse of the office. You know, people making these requests. You know, give us everything. Touching on a particular issue, which is a big request for documents. The other side, the people who oppose this, they say it's a transparency and accountability issue. Taxpayers are already paying for the public offices, so they should have a right to the information. So there is kind of I think the ACLU is involved in this. It's got there is a civil liberties component to this, but there's no denying, you know, you get a few gadflies or people are in there who see it as their job to keep government honest, and they can really tie things up. So it's not only that, but that's kind of part of the issue.
And some of these requests, Dean, you're right, they can be incredibly onerous.
Ridiculously broad,
somebody
right.
asked for every single email for the past 3 years.
Yeah, and it becomes a political football. And,
right.
Sure. Now there's a – go ahead.
But on the other side, speaking as a reporter, I mean there are communities that do not actually make public information
right.
available and any easy way to access it. And, I mean, this is an open kind of – if you can allow somebody to charge you all this money, right. I mean, it's very easy to charge a lot of money so to keep people away from it.
Right.
And, I mean, the classic example is the town of Windsor, which was not charging property taxes to friends and families of the selectmen. And it took an awful lot of right-to-know requests to finally get to this. And that's a classic example. And it's a rarity, but it does happen. I mean, the town of Ware is another notorious place for being hard to find information. You know?
So the there is a federal law, the Freedom of Information Act. Of course, every state does have its own version, right to know here in New Hampshire. There's and beyond the cost issue, all of these laws are a little bit different. There's a particular exemption in New Hampshire's law that certainly the Republicans have been chewing on this season or session rather. Gary, what's that exemption all about and what's going to happen to it?
Well, the governor's office has claimed for quite some time that it's exempt from the right-to-know law. So there was a ruling a while back. I mean, you can argue one way or the other about whether it actually exempt them or it didn't. But Senator Jeanne Forrester introduced a bill which would make it very clear that the governor's office is not exempt from the right-to-know law.
I came here from New York 2 years ago, and in the Freedom of Information law there, the legislature wrote the law and exempted themselves. So sort of an interesting change.
We've always had this huge loophole in terms of state government, which is called working papers. You know, so they're always claiming that they're working papers, so they're exempt from the
draft.
There's a sort of a privileged communications aspect of this. You see it at the presidential level as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, Gary, you mentioned you're a reporter. I'm a reporter, and certainly we have a vested interest in making sure these laws work. But Dean, it's important for the public to have access to this too. Especially, I'll put a little plug in here for Sunshine Week. This is a national effort every March, where media outlets get together and they press for more accountability, more transparency. Right. Why should people care?
Well, I think that Gary and I have kind of painted the two sides of the argument. There's certainly an abuse aspect of it, but there's also a legitimate accountability aspect. You know, in a democratic society, you're supposed to be able to hold your elected officials accountable. Their actions are supposed to be transparent. As Gary noted, sometimes it does take right-to-know requests or freedom of information requests to kind of figure out that there are shenanigans going on, but it can also be used as kind of a political weapon as well. So there's got to be some sort of happy medium here to kind of make everybody happy. I don't know if they'll figure out where that is, though.
This is The Exchange. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Remember, you can join us on the phone, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Okay, guys, on to the presidential primary. Just a little under a year away now, we expect anyway. And they're starting to visit. The hopefuls are starting to visit. Dean Spiliotis, I'd like to start off with the most recent visit this week came on Monday when New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was here.
Yeah.
He's facing a little bit of headwinds right now. Talk about Chris Christie.
Yeah, Chris Christie, he was the head of the Republican Governors Association. I think he was here something like five times when Walt Havenstein was the Republican nominee for governor in the last election. He returned this week to headline the Lincoln-Reagan dinner. This is the Concord and Merrimack County GOP dinner. He kind of defended his blunt style. He said, you know, kind of what you see is what you get. There's not going to be a kinder, gentler Chris Christie out there. He is who he is, and he's comfortable with that. He also went after Maggie Hassan. It's always interesting to me when granted, he has his connection through the Governors Association, so he is following gubernatorial politics, but, you know, he basically came into the state and said that Governor Hassan was mainly focused on setting herself up for a Senate run against Kelly Ayotte, which is kind of the unspoken question in the room. He also went after President Obama, so the kinds of things you'd expect to hear from a presidential candidate, the sort of injecting himself into our state politics aside. Pretty much what you would expect. He is facing a lot of headwinds. You know, he's just had a number of issues that have been subject to state and federal investigation. He had a very rough trip to London recently where, you know, we're suddenly seeing all of our gubernatorial presidential hopefuls go to London to get some sort of foreign policy cred. That's the new stopover, and they all seem to be having trouble over there. So he had a rough trip. There are a lot of stories about kind of luxurious expensing or accepting trips and plane flights from individuals. So there just always seems to be a lot of stuff kind of swirling around him. And part of it, I think, is his personality, and part of it is sort of his governing style. There's certainly plenty there for opponents, but he's a very forceful politician, very charismatic, and I think he's seriously considering running. Despite all this.
And I think, too, there was a poll that came out this week or last week which had him actually in third place behind Jeb Bush and Scott Walker, which is, you know, he's certainly been here lots of times, and neither Jeb Bush or Scott Walker have
actually been here yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so that was not a good news for Chris Christie.
No, and the Dean, you mentioned the spending issue with Chris Christie. In 2009, when he was running for governor in New Jersey, the AP reported that as the U.S. attorney in that state, he was routinely exceeding Department of Justice guidelines for expenses, mostly by staying at top-flight hotels and eating at four-star restaurants, et cetera.
Yep.
Not the only name in politics, though. Certainly, we've got some staffing going on, from some of the biggest names. Rick Perry, he's staffed up in Iowa now, and he's got some. He was back in New Hampshire 2 weeks ago. Gary Reno, what do you see with some of these hires and some of the moves among the other candidates?
Well, I think perhaps the most interesting one was Jim Merrill signing
on
with Rubio, which Jim Merrill was a key guy for Mitt Romney in the last two presidential elections. Certainly cut his teeth in the Steve Merrill gubernatorial administration, and has been a key player in the state and presidential politics ever since. Big landing for Senator Rubio, obviously. I mean, there have been some others, Rich Killian with Jeb Bush. That's another big name. And we've seen Mike Dennehy has been with Perry for quite a while. I think he was with Perry the last time, too.
And Andy Leach
with Scott Walker.
He's a former New Hampshire Republican Party executive director. So it's interesting that people, you know, it's one of the things you do when you run for president is you line up, key staff in the states who can help you negotiate the state. A lot of these guys are now being hired to work for these individuals' PACs, right? It used to be you set up an exploratory committee. Now we're seeing everybody sets up a PAC, and then they hire people into the PAC, but it serves the same process.
Yeah.
Interesting, you mentioned Rubio and Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, Jeb Bush, who was a political mentor of his, and now they're sort of on the, you know, running for the same slot here. Interesting discussion from Jeb Bush this week, Dean Spiliotis, when he said, I'm not my brother, I'm not my father. How does that dynamic, how does Bush trying to establish his identity and Marco Rubio trying to move out of Jeb Bush's shadow. How do they – what's the interplay there?
Jeb Bush gave a sort of what was viewed as kind of a big foreign policy speech. Got kind of mixed reviews, but he did – what one thing that did get a lot of attention was this idea that you know, he's not his father and he's not his brother and he's going to be his own – he literally said, I'm my own man and so I'm going to be an independent you know, thinker on foreign policy. He needs to kind of establish himself separately, although he did release a list of his key foreign policy advisors. And that's what you'd expect. It's all people from the last couple of Republican administrations, some Reagan, some from his father's administration, and some from George W. Bush. So Democrats have been having fun with that list, juxtaposing it to him saying he's his own man. So there's no doubt that that's going to be a challenge for him. You know, he says he's coming to New Hampshire. His brother did not do particularly well in New Hampshire, was beaten very handily in 2000 by John McCain. We'll see if his brother's able to develop a different relationship. He's leading here in the polls, not by a huge amount, but he's sort of in the mid-teens. So if he spends time here, he certainly has an opportunity.
Gary, we saw this week former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who ran for president in 2012. He makes a comment where he essentially says Barack Obama doesn't love America the way Rudy Giuliani loves America. What's going on there? And is there a ripple effect to these presidential candidates this cycle? Do they need to distance themselves from Rudy Giuliani? What's going on?
Well, certainly statements like that aren't going to make them run to him, I don't think. I mean, it's you wonder what he was thinking when he said something like that, because it certainly is going to send shockwaves around a lot of places. But, you know, he never got traction here in New Hampshire at all. I mean, for one thing, he kind of almost tried to bypass New Hampshire, and people knew that here. He didn't spend much time here. He had a strategy that looked beyond New Hampshire and Iowa to the larger southern states and to the western states. And he laid a bomb here.
Really. He's often held up as how not to translate political capital from 9/11 into what most people thought should have been a successful run here in New Hampshire. Just didn't happen.
No.
Well, we also heard from, speaking of Florida Senator Marco Rubio, we spoke with him yesterday. Kathleen Ronan of the Associated Press talked to him. And he says if he decides to run, assuming he decides to run, he used those qualifiers quite often, but if he runs, we're going to see an awful lot of him. That's the game plan, right, Dean? I mean, there's no – you have to be here early. You have to be here often. You have to win people over.
You do. I mean, I think there was actually an interesting conversation on Exchange yesterday talking about with Dan Balls and EJ Dion talking about how the primary has changed over the last 20 plus years. And I would suggest anybody who's interested in that listen to the podcast. Retail politics is still the way to go. I think money is increasingly important because people are no longer focused on the spending limits so that they can get the federal matching funds. Everybody's just raising as much money as possible, particularly in the first tier of candidates. But, you know, it comes down to retail politics. It comes down to not only meeting voters, but because of technology, social media, digital media, you know, what you do here becomes sort of blown up onto the larger national and international scene. So it's in some sense less regional, but also more important now because it really speaks to whatever you do here, it speaks to what you do as a candidate nationally because of technology.
Interesting stuff. We'll be talking about this a lot, I think, in the coming months for sure. Last thing we got to mention, and I promise I will no longer complain about this cold weather when I look at the summit of Mount Washington. This week it had recorded the second coldest spot on the planet. Second only to Antarctica at a nice toasty minus 35 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh, plus a 141-mile-an-hour wind. So remember, guys, only 29 days till spring, so keep hoping. I want to thank Gary Reno and Dean Spiliotis. Next week on The Exchange, Dean, you know, you're sitting in for Laura a couple of days next week. What do you got going?
Monday through Wednesday. We're going to do a show. I believe Monday we're doing a show on redistricting and the impact that that's had on our politics. I think Tuesday we're going to look at the nuclear situation with Iran. And Wednesday we're going to talk about whether or not there's going to be a Democratic primary. And if so, what might Democrats actually talk about? We've been so focused on Republicans recently.
Well, and I forgot to mention, we can actually talk about a Democrat. We've got
Biden's coming.
We've actually got a couple coming here to the state. We have a couple of former governors coming here, Jim Gilmore from Virginia and Michael O'Malley from, is it Michael?
Mark O'Malley.
Martin O'Malley.
Martin O'Malley
from Maryland. So
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden's coming in too.
Sure. Gary, how about you? What's up for you next
week? Well, the legislature is on vacation next week, and so am I.
Enjoy. Go someplace warm, hopefully.
I'll put a plug in for an Associated Press report coming out this weekend on transportation spending. It's a national look at the data of the Federal Highway Trust Fund, which from 2008 to 2013 has dropped in all but two states. And it did drop here in New Hampshire by about 5%. We talk about what the impact was on those roads. I would like to thank everybody for joining us here today on The Exchange, the NHBR Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Gary, thanks very much for being here.
You're very welcome, sir.
And Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at the Southern New Hampshire University, author of the political website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, thanks for having us.
Sure thing, Rick.
My name's Rick Stevens. I'm sitting in for Laura Kanoy this week. And The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. The theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Again, I'm Rick Stevens of the Associated Press, in for Laura Kanoy. Thanks for joining us.